In the summer of 1897, an explorer named Solomon André took off from Sweden in an attempt to discover the North Pole by flying over it in a hydrogen balloon. It was said to be the most original and remarkable attempt ever made in Arctic exploration. André got into his balloon, he floated off, and he was never heard from again. And for more than 30 years, his fate remained a mystery. We'll get that story in this hour of Focus as we talk with Alec Wilkinson. He writes for The New Yorker and is author of a book that's titled The Ice Balloon, Essay André and the Heroic Age of Arctic Exploration. Knopf is the publisher. The book is just recently out. You can find it in the bookstore or wherever you buy your books. And questions here are welcome, too. We'd definitely like to have people involved in the conversation. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you would like to join us. You can do that. And Alec Wilkinson, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Great. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. It's a remarkable story. There's a photograph on the jacket of the book, and I understand it was this photograph, or perhaps one like it, that got you interested in exploring the story and telling the story. Can you describe this photo?
It's as strange a photograph as the archives of exploration provide. It's almost surreal. It shows this immense balloon on its side in an atmosphere of whiteness, which is, of course, the ice and there and the sky, which is white too. There's very little horizon often in the Arctic landscape. When I first saw it, my wife found it in an obscure little book about the history of ballooning. And I merely assumed that it was a kind of Edwardian or Victorian lark of the kind that Monty Python got such traction with, because it didn't seem possible that it's so surreal and so strange and didn't seem possible that it could be an actual image. And if it were actual, there was a further mystery, which is, how did it then exist? How did the men who were standing there were two men beside the balloon, sort of looking at it like detectives, called to the scene of a crime. If it were an actual photograph, I thought, how is it possible that it exists? What happened to those men, and how was this brought into being?
Yeah, around this time, there was a lot of excitement about the issue of exploration, and people went to the hardest places that you could get to, and they climbed mountains, and they trekked up the Amazon. It seemed that though the poles always held a particular kind of significance, and in a way, the North more than the South, and perhaps that it was because at least people knew the South Pole, there was a landmass
right there,
but the North Pole was something that was an altogether different matter.
Right, and whalers had been close enough and comprehensively enough around Antarctica to see land pretty much everywhere and to realize what they were looking at. But no one who ever got in the vicinity of the Arctic ice ever saw anything but ice. So there was that was one of the first reasons that a mystery surrounded the place. But there were also for many centuries, geographers had believed that there was a tropical sea at the heart of the Arctic, because the reason they did is in their minds that's what accounted for icebergs, because something they thought had to warm the ice sufficiently that these great masses of ice broke off from it, and to them the most persuasive observation was that there was warm water up there. For centuries, as long as people had been aware that the farther north you went, the stranger it got, there had been legends about the Arctic and as a refuge of all sorts, as a god-haunted place. Some of the ancients believe that Lucifer lived in the Arctic, in the north, in a house of fire. It was a place that was both holy and infernal. That is to say, it was so receptive as a screen for projections from all from mythology and from magic thinking and from ideas of spirituality and God thinking that anything seemed to apply as a possibility for what the landscape up there might contain. And of course, there was the mystery of why the compass needle pointed there. It seemed to have an extra significance in the idea that it seemed to be the primary destination on Earth, the
yeah.
one that due north, true north.
And that I'm really struck here, in fact, by the fact that over a period of, maybe about 400 years or so, more than something like 130 different expeditions went there.
Yes. Yeah, originally they were trying to find a passage either to the east or to the west, a means of reaching India and China, because I want to say, this is the sort of thing that some listener, astute listener, will call and correct me on, but let me say at the end of the 15th century, since I know it was the 15th century, the Pope had divided the world between Portugal and Spain, giving them rights of passage to the southern waters. So suddenly England is faced, if it's going to have an eastern trade, is faced with how to get there. So they begin looking north and trying to find a northwest passage and a northeast passage. So they're voyages of commerce. They're filling in the map, but these adventurers are going off in the hopes of finding riches. That sort of comes to an end around the middle of the 19th century when Sir John Franklin is lost in the Arctic and becomes the most famous person ever to be lost there. He was attempting to complete the Northwest Passage, and he disappeared. And years later, it was, of course, found out that his ships had been confined by the ice and crushed, and that the men had died in the retreat. But pretty much after he disappears, the voyages to the Arctic become more or less search parties for Franklin. And furthermore, though, it is the period when you begin to get the people who are really simply going to discover the North Pole. Beforehand, that had been less of a means than simply those concerns of commerce. But that's when you start to get the guys who are really, some of them God haunted, some of them adventurers and explorers, who have really declared our mission is to try to get not only the farthest north, but to finally discover the secret of the North Pole.
Yeah, and in Andre's case, certainly one of the things that makes this unique is the unconventional means. Other people had tried to do this, but they took boats.
Yeah.
Why did he decide that this would be the way to try to do it?
Well, there's a kind of contradiction in Andre because, of course, he's chosen this novel and even apparently eccentric means for the approach to the pole, but he's an engineer and a deeply practical man, and he's essentially saying, listen, you people in your ships and sledges, you've had 300 years of active search through this territory, and all of you have failed. It simply, we'll never get, if we're waiting for you to discover the pole, we'll never get there. We could be waiting centuries for you people and your clumsy apparatus to arrive. The only means is the modern means. We must use the air, which Andre saw as a kind of corridor, particularly the upper atmosphere, as a kind of corridor of winds, a highway, really, that would take him there. And he was trying to demonstrate the practicality of the notion that balloons would be the new modern means of transport for freight and people. And he thought, if I can discover the pole and show you that a long journey can be made in a hydrogen balloon along a specified course, then of course there I will have demonstrated that these are practical conveyances for commerce. So he had the other people had more or less all gone north under the shadow of the impression of the Romantic Age and the strange things that would be found there and the territory to be conquered and possessed and the mysteries to be solved. And Andre was really, gosh darn it, I'm going to show, I'm a modern scientific man. I've had it with you people who have fanciful ideas about the rigor necessary to undertake these glamorous expeditions. I'm going to reach the place in a few days.
And perhaps it was that ultimately it was that kind of attitude that was his undoing.
Well, yes and no in a way. I mean, the problem for Andre, you see, all the other people who had gone to the poll were all following each other's steps. They all had each other's accounts to study and to call the mistakes from and correct. They were sort of, each man who went successively could think, if only those others had known what I'd know. Andre was the pioneer. He was the futurist, the first one to do something. So it would be generations before, or decades before, others aviators could look back at Andre and think, if only he had known what I know. So Columbus was the figure that he was most often compared to at the period. So he had all of the risks attended on being a pioneer and going, selecting this means, which had plenty to say in to recommend it, and a few things to say that might lead a person to say, gee, this is an awfully perilous undertaking. Unfortunately, what Andre really sailed into was the worst conditions possible for a balloon, and that's what doomed him. There, certainly under other conditions, he might have made it, but he did have the worst luck that he could have had.
Well, was the reaction to the proposal that this man was an heroic pioneer visionary, or that he was kidding himself and, in fact, he was going into something that would be very likely to lead to failure and his death?
Yeah, I think most of the people thought, he's a nut.
In short.
This is absolute. Well, but of course they're defending territory. I mean, he outraged all the people who. Andre was not a, what's the word? He's certainly not a delicate. He's a big, aggressive man who really felt most comfortable with things he could put his hands on, machines, tools, things such as that. He had no real feeling for art or, notions of romance. He was an anti-romantic of a kind, and which is what strangely made him the first modern explorer to go to the Arctic. He outraged all. He didn't approach the people delicately who were defending the territory of we go on these arduous voyages that take us years to make and return from. He sort of said, you people are failures. And so of course they unleashed all guns on him, they regarded his idea as not only eccentric but something that ought to be dismissed. But Andre knew more about what he was doing than all of the people who were dismissing him.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Alec Wilkinson, writes for The New Yorker. He has published 9 books, I guess 10 altogether, including the one that we're talking about here.
Right.
2 memoirs, 2 collections of essays, 3 biological portraits, 2 pieces of reporting, most of which first indeed appeared in the magazine, in The New Yorker. His new book is The Ice Balloon, the story of explorer Essay Andre and his attempt to float over the North Pole in a hydrogen balloon. And it's a great story. Knopf is the publisher, and we'll give you some more of the story in a moment here. We'll just keep you on edge as we take another opportunity to ask for support of the station. This is an effort that we do, and periodically during the year we do it. And we do it because we think it's really the best way to get the message out there that support from listeners is important. And as I'm sure I've said at least once, there are folks who have loyally supported the station for years, years and years and years. And we just cannot thank them enough. What we want to do is reach out to people who, for whatever reason, have been listeners but not supporters, and remind you just how vital your financial contribution is. So this is one of those times that you can make the contribution really easy. You can call. You can go online. Right now would be a great time to do it. Dave Teal is here with me to help make the argument. He's the program director for WILL Television.
Yes, and it's great to be here. You know, we, you know, people ask us sometimes, you know, why do you have these pledge drives? And, well, I mean, the obvious reason, of course, is, you know, we need to make some money so that we can continue to run the station, run the lights, run the equipment, and, you know, occasionally put food on the table. But, you know, part of the reason, too, we have pledge drives is that's the way, that's the best way to reach you. You know, presumably tuned in, you're listening right now, you're here for a reason. And this is the best way that we have of talking directly to you. And we hope that, you know, we try to keep these brief. We hope that we don't annoy you overly much. We hope that you will, though, hear what we're saying, you know, that that this is something that's worth supporting, that this needs financial support, because it's not going to come, you know, from heaven. It's not going to come from, you know, I mean, some of it's going to come from the government, but not enough of it, certainly, never enough of it. We need to hear from you right now at 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org.
Yeah, no one's going to drift over the building in a balloon and drop money on us, as nice as that might be.
I would like that, actually, but yeah.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Alec Wilkinson. He writes for The New Yorker and is the author of the book The Ice Balloon, Essai André and the Heroic Age of Arctic Exploration. Knopf is the publisher. Questions are certainly welcome. Folks want to call in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's 800-222-9455. And if you want to send us an email, you can do that too, will-talk@illinois.edu. Back here with Alec Wilkinson. You talked about the fact that he ran into maybe some of the worst conditions possible, and so partly this might have been bad luck. But was actually the technology of ballooning up to the task of being able to operate under these conditions?
It should have been. If you know, there isn't any reason. He built a balloon that should have been able to stay aloft for the amount of time that was required. But, you know, but the other answer, the other way to approach it is, what you're really saying is, there was no way to know. He was really, he was doing a novel thing, a unique thing. He was taking a craft that had proved itself adaptable for normal, usual circumstances, and subjecting it to extreme circumstances, and he found out pretty quickly that one of the extremes that balloonists don't normally encounter, being cold and fog at the same time, was going to be, you know, was beyond the capacity of this balloon to to survive.
So very, it seems like very, very relatively quickly, because I think he managed to make it about 60 hours or so. It sounds like what happened was that simply the balloon iced up, and there was no way that it could handle the additional weight of the buildup of the ice on the balloon.
It was that, and also the fog, which obscured the light. You know, the hydrogen balloons they must be the most absurdly sensitive craft that ever go aloft. You know, shadows falling on them cause them to descend, and too much sunlight causes them to rise. It's a very complicated task of releasing hydrogen and also and releasing ballast to keep these things at a stable altitude. They can go in and out of shadows and fog and sunlight, but they can't exist entirely in cold and fog, because the cold and the fog will simply cause the gas to continue to cool and shrink, and the only way to compensate is to continue to throw out ballast, but at a certain point you'll be out of ballast.
Mm-hmm. You talked earlier about the fact that probably a lot of people thought that he was just crazy to attempt this, although he certainly did have supporters, among them the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, the King, and none other than Alfred Nobel.
Well, you know, there's a parenthesis there, which is all Swedes. The Swedes felt by means of propinquity that they ought to be the ones to discover the pole, that it was a kind of honor that belonged to them, and they certainly wanted to get there before the Norwegians. And, you know, in the year before André left, Fridtjof Nansen, the Norwegian, established the farthest north you know, and becoming a rival and competitor to Andre. So, you know, I think there was always a kind of, you know, gosh, we don't even have to, not to get too controversial, but we don't even have to look at some of the military actions by our own government that, you know, haven't worked out so well around the world in the last, you know, 15 years to know what elements of kind of, you know, shock and awe is sort of about the idea of thinking, well, we'll prevail because we're Americans. And they, Andre and the King and Alfred Nobel and the Swedish Academy thought, well, you know, there is something specific to the Swedish character that will deliver us this prize. And you know, furthermore, we are, you know, we're entitled to it. Mm-hmm. It's our Swedish honor rests on the matter. So, he had a lot of support among Swedes, not very much support among the Americans or the English, and certainly almost none, not very much among the Norwegians.
Well, does that have, you know, today there certainly is an issue of control of the Arctic and its resources, and the various nations that border on it all want to make claim on it as if to say, well, because it's near us, it's ours, or part of it should be ours. Yeah. Was that kind of thing in operation even then in the late 19th century?
No, not to, it was more an intellectual idea, a certain sense of, you know, we are the sturdiest people of the North. We will prove our mettle by claiming the greatest prize left on Earth, the discovery of the world's last mysterious destination. I don't think anybody thought possession of territory mattered less in those days, of course, because whatever it is, first of all, there weren't so many people on the planet competing for territory. Second of all, you know, whatever resources there were in the Arctic were not particularly of interest to anybody. Nobody now, it's I suppose to a degree about oil and passage and all sorts of things. But in those days, it was a kind of pure ideal. You know, it was this will reflect on the character of the Swedish nation.
So it was bragging rights, maybe.
Yes, bragging rights, exactly. You know, the English have failed, the Americans have failed, the Norwegians have failed, the Swedes will do it.
Yeah. He didn't go alone. He took two other men with him, and we talked right at the beginning about this photograph that had caught your eye and that got you interested. And indeed, there was a photographer along. The photographs did survive and eventually were found, so that's how we have some record.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, the man who took the photograph was Nils Strindberg, who was related to the playwright,
right.
Strindberg.
Yes, August Strindberg was his godfather and a relation through his a cousin of his father, I believe, is what the relationship was. Yeah, Strindberg had been he was the youngest on the expedition. He had been a physics student. He was about 24, I think, when they left. He'd been a physics student and had either attended a lecture by Andre and volunteered or been introduced by his physics professor to Andre. And very much a romantic. Before he left, he got engaged and carried with him a locket containing a photograph of his fiance and a locket of her strands of her hair, and he wrote letters to her, particularly in the first beginning of the expedition, wrote letters to her in shorthand, apparently, I suppose, so the others couldn't read it. He kind of had a sort of a touching, boyish quality to him, and very much taken with the idea of returning to Sweden as a member of the great expedition that had discovered the North Pole. And sort of, you know, touchingly good-hearted young man. The third member of the party was a much more physically substantial figure, a man named Knut Frankel. I suppose Knut Frankel would be the proper pronunciation. And he was going to be, he'd been an engineering student, not a particularly great mind, but very capable physically, so he was going to do the heavy lifting.
Yeah. Questions are certainly welcome. People want to get involved in the conversation, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, as we continue to talk with Alec Wilkinson about his book, The Ice Balloon. Well, so they loaded everything up. Got this balloon. It was certainly, I think we should not underestimate the engineering feat that was required just to produce it and get the thing going and to launch it.
Yeah.
And so they were there, they got in the balloon, they drifted off, and they were never heard from again, or at least not until some 30 years later when their remains were found.
Right. Yeah, you know, the balloon was 100 feet tall. It was just a kind of craft that had never been built before. And, you know, exquisite care taken to manufacture this, to design and manufacture this thing and get it to the Arctic and filled and protected properly in an octagonal hangar that they built that had windows made out of gelatin and every surface of which was covered, every surface of the interior was covered with felt to make sure that nothing abraded the balloon. And they took off. It took an hour for them to disappear, and then they were gone. They were the first people ever to disappear into the air. You know, another first accomplishment for them. Years passed where, of course, it was common in those days for Arctic expeditions to take years. We can no longer go anywhere on the Earth using the fastest means possible and take a year to get there and come back. But it wasn't uncommon, and Andre knew when he left that he might not return for 2 years or 3 years, depending on the circumstances, you know, how far he had to walk if the balloon didn't go on the path that he regarded as the ideal one, which was to land somewhere either in the Canadian wilderness or the Siberian wilderness, close enough for him to walk to some sort of vestige of civilization. Hmm. And they are found by a sealing boat that is visiting an island in the Arctic Ocean that is so remote that it's not even placed properly on the maps. And the sealers follow some walruses. They're hunting walrus on this particular day, and they chase them around a point of land. And a couple of hours later, they return to the boat with a book. And it is a journal, and on the front page it says, "The Sledge Journey, 1897. And this is 1930 when the sealers have found them. And there have been years and years. Andre's expedition was news all internationally when he left. It was the biggest story of the period, and every newspaper in all countries had front page stories about Andre's preparations for leaving, Andre's camp and reports from the camp and bulletins as they were preparing to leave, and then finally the departure. And this continued into speculation for years of where is Andre, what has happened to him, and finally became, of course, he couldn't have survived. What actually did happen to Andre? And I think for a lot of newspapers, when there was sort of really nothing to do for years, for 20, 25 years after, some editor would say, all right, go find one of Andre's relatives and ask him what he thinks happened. And they'd sometimes run stories thousands of pages long about where Andre was or what had happened to him. But in fact, he had the journals revealed and the photographs revealed that they had made this death march across the ice and finally died at this camp that they had established on White Island.
We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Alec Wilkinson. We're talking about his recent book, The Ice Balloon, the story of this expedition, this ill-fated attempt by the Swedish explorer Salomon Andre to sail over the North Pole in a balloon. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Community Concierge and American Concierge magazines. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and a business and shopping guide. Concierge magazines are distributed throughout central Illinois and always present the Champaign-Urbana and Bloomington-Normal areas at their best.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics for you every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. Tomorrow morning on the show, we'll talk with Mark Braverman in hour number one. He is co-founder and executive director of Friends of Tent of Nations North America. We'll talk about his book, Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land. And then we'll talk a little bit about the local regional environment here in the second part of the program with Rob Cantor. He's a visiting communications specialist in the Environmental Change Institute at the U of I. And perhaps if you listen to our station, you hear his commentaries. They also appear in our newspaper. Joining us as well will be Dr. Julia Whittington. She is a veterinarian And her special thing is wildlife biology. In fact, she's director of the Wildlife Clinic at the College of Vet Medicine at the U of I. So we'll talk about birds and wildlife and take whatever questions people have. We are here, as I say, weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. Always welcome your questions and comments. You can find out what we'll do in the days ahead and listen to past programs by going to the website, which is will.illinois.edu. Now, there's something else you can do on that website. You can go there and you can make a pledge of financial support to this station, or you can just go to willpledge.org. And in recent years, I think more and more people have decided they wanted to do it that way. Now, there's also the tried and true way of picking up the telephone and giving us a call. And if you want to do that, the number is 217-244-9455. Now, what are you doing when you do that? Well, what you're doing is helping to pay a little bit of the cost of the programs that you enjoy. And that's the thing that makes public broadcasting special. The public, that's you, the folks who listen and watch, understand that it's a partnership, and they're paying part of the cost, just a part. And if everybody who listened and watched paid a little part, we'd be doing just fine. So that's what we're trying to do here, is get as many as possible of our audience to be actively involved and do that by making a pledge. Dave Teal is the program director for our TV station, and he's been here with me this morning to help make the pitch.
And, you know, you might be sitting there thinking, well, that's a great idea, David, either David. but you know, how much should I pledge to WILL? Well, you know, it really is up to you, but we're going to offer you a suggestion here. You know, you can give an amount that reflects how much you use this service. And so, you know, maybe if you listen once a week, maybe you give $1 a week. Maybe that's $52 a year. You know, if you listen, you know, every weekday, maybe, you know, consider being a major donor at the $250 level. We hope that, you know, whatever you choose will fit into your budget. And you know, think about the things that you spend a dollar on a day. I mean, I blow at least that much on soda pop every day. And, you know, it's so, you know, you can put some of that money perhaps to, well, a different use, not necessarily a better use, but, you know. We like to think it's a better use, so we hope you'll give us a call right now at 217-244-9455 or go to willpledge.org.
And in this hour, our guest is Alec Wilkinson. He writes for The New Yorker. He has published a number of books, memoirs, collections of essays, biological portraits, two pieces of reporting, most of which first appeared in The New Yorker, and his new book is The Ice Balloon. And it is all about this man, S.A. Andre, who made this ill-fated attempt to sail over the North Pole in a hydrogen balloon. This was 1897. He was lost in the attempt. And you can read all about it in the book. It's published by Knopf. And questions, comments are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You know, we talked a little bit about the fact that it was a photograph that got you interested,
right?
And that this man Strindberg was along on the expedition and he was the photographer. And
right.
And you know, actually, I guess I'm thinking about how powerful photographs can be, and of photographs of this particular kind of landscape. And I guess actually the thing sort of comes to my mind is that this has been some years, but there was a lot of publishing around another explorer on the other end of the globe, Ernest Shackleton, and the exploration he had done at the South Pole. And part of what was just so cool and so exciting about that, not only was it a great story, but there were some just fabulous, fabulous photographs of him and his expedition to the South Pole. Can you also see more pictures, more of Strindberg's pictures from this?
Can someone?
Yes,
see
can someone see that?
There are. Well, there are also. I guess there are about 15 in the book or something. There's a certain amount number in the book, there is a museum. An Andre Museum that's in the town of Grana in Sweden, and they have a website that has some has photographs on it.
Okay, so because I'm just I was the others are so knocking out. They're so beautiful and powerful and dramatic that I was really thinking, God, I would like to have the opportunity to see some more pictures.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the only place I know of that there are more other than in my own book.
Okay. Well, so we have told a little bit about, talked a little bit about the man, talked a little bit about the journey, about the fact that the idea here was that this kind of balloon, the your ability to control it was minimal. And I think his idea was if he was lucky, the winds would just be going in the right way so that the balloon would come up, it would drift over, he'd be able to wave to the pole, and it would end up landing in Alaska or someplace in Asia. And there, though there was, I guess, that they had some kind of mechanism that was designed to help them do some steering, but it sounds as if it didn't, it was not right from the very moment that they took off.
Right. Andre had devised, he was a practical-minded engineer, but he also had an innovative cast of mind, and he had devised a system of using these three heavy ropes, very heavy ropes, that would drag along the ground. He called them drag ropes, and they would slow the balloon down because, as you point out, a balloon can only, hot air or hydrogen, can only travel in the direction of the wind and at the same speed of the wind. So to steer it, you either have to make it go faster than the wind, which would require an engine, or you have to slow it down, so you, like a sailboat, will have some resistance to it. So Andre slowed his balloon down. He'd carried off this system on an earlier balloon that he'd had. He'd slowed the balloon down with the drag ropes, and that allowed him to hoist a sail, which he could then put at different angles to the wind and get courses that deviated from the wind as nearly as much as 40 degrees. So this was the idea that made his trip practical, because if he really couldn't steer his balloon at all, it hardly made sense. I mean, then it's sort of a crapshoot. You launch and do you get the winds, and who knows where you go. And this was a fantastically expensive expedition for the period. So you're not likely to get a lot of backing or financial support, money to do such a thing. So he had this system, but then they had a catastrophe on the launch, and that is that one of the problems, and it gives you sort of a sense of the fineness, the meticulous quality of Andre's thinking, he had already realized that one of the problems that could occur is that his drag ropes could catch on something, and then, of course, he stuck. So he devised a system that would allow him from the balloon to make the ropes part, and it involved having the ropes being joined at their midpoint, more or less, by these brass fittings, which he could control from the basket. And not only that, but if the brass fittings failed, he had a little device that he could, with an explosive charge, that he could send down the line and then ignite the charge, which would set off a knife that would cut the rope. So you can see from this how carefully he thought about all of this. But in taking off, the ropes became tangled and then unscrewed. And so they sailed toward the horizon without his steering mechanism, although he did have enough rope aboard to repair the ropes if he had to, and it was never really, it turned out not to be the issue particularly that caused him disaster.
Yeah. Well, I have somebody who is listening who would like to join the conversation, someone who is in Savoy community nearby, so we'll go there.
Okay.
Line number four. Hello.
Yeah, David, thank you. Great program, very interesting. Time is short, so I'll just ask a couple of quick questions and get off. I was wondering, and I joined the conversation late, so forgive me if you've already covered this, but I was wondering, with all the plans he had for steering the balloon, did he have a plan if, in fact, he did reach the North Pole to try to land, or was his idea just simply somehow to fly over it and mark it? And that was one question. And then the other one was, did they ever, because of the cold, well, the other question I had was, not knowing anything about ballooning, I always thought that hydrogen balloons flew at a great altitude where would make any sort of a rope mechanism not very useful. And then because of the extreme cold, I was wondering, did they ever find the remains? Or I'm guessing they probably just froze to death and, you know, befell by some sort of polar bear or something. I'll go ahead and listen offline. Thanks.
Okay.
Okay. So three questions there. What was the first one?
Well, was the idea, as he sailed over the pole, how would they mark the fact that that's where they had been?
Exactly. Three good questions. They had several buoys drop out of the balloon as they made their journey, and which were going to have reports in them. And the biggest of these was called the pole buoy, and that they were going to drop over the North Pole to mark it. But they also hoped that the conditions might permit them to slow down enough either to drop an anchor or by some means get down actually onto the ice and collect samples and that sort of thing. And not merely fly over as Amundsen did in 1926 when, as I say, he was the first one to first undisputed sighting of the pole. Hydrogen balloons flying at great altitude? No, not necessarily. Andre planned to fly his at about 250 meters, and these drag ropes were about roughly 1,700 feet long. So. The idea was that the lower you are, the more rope is on the ice, keeping you close. And if you wanted to ascend, then it began to work as ballast because obviously, if it's not supported by the ground, it's being supported by the balloon. And they were apparently what happened to them is that they died. And were encased in ice at some point and covered with snow. And oddly, this August of 1930 in which they were found happened to be a particularly warm one. And what had happened was that the snow melted and the camp was exposed. But it had probably been under ice all that time. They did not get frozen before polar bears got to them, so the bodies were not entirely intact. When they were found, but the three bodies were eventually all discovered. One of them had been buried in a typical Arctic grave, and that means placed on the ground, which was frozen, and then rocks piled on top of it. So that one, that was Strindberg, and he had been a little more preserved than the other two. Although Frankel, when he was found, was entirely under ice. And Andre, though, had been exposed.
So what happened was, they launched the balloon, they sailed off, they managed to sail for maybe about 3 days,
right.
Covering almost 300 miles when the balloon came down. So they did not die in the crash. I mean, the balloon came down.
They came down. So I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Sure.
They came down so gently that they had carrier pigeons aboard, for example, and the birds weren't disturbed. Not a single one of the delicate scientific instruments were disturbed. They came down, they settled, and stepped out of the balloon.
Yeah, and they had indeed made plans, some plans for the possibility that they actually would have to walk out.
Yes, they were well provisioned to make such a. In fact, they were probably one of the things that contributed to their deaths is they were too well provisioned, and they ended up with sledges that were so heavy that they were at certain points twice as heavy as what the British sledgers, who were the greatest sledgers in the world, recommended, which is 200 pounds. Andre Frankel at times was hauling a sledge that was pretty close to 400 pounds.
That just I can't quite imagine that. I mean, what would be you would be working here under difficult circumstances, first of all, and just the very possibility of dying from exposure and to put that additional physical burden on you. I don't know exactly how anybody would be up to that.
Would survive it? Yeah. No, well, they really wouldn't. I mean, there's a remark in the book where one of Fridtjof Nansen's men goes off pulling a sledge. To weighing 250 pounds, and Nansen writes that he got a little bit of a ways and then came back to the ship with a very gloomy cast of on his face and said that, a man might as well die as try to make any headway hauling a sledge that weighed that much. So you know, they just, they Strindberg, Frankel, and compared to the really fortified explorers, these were not classic outdoorsmen. They were, Frankel was something close to that, but Strindberg, was a young man raised up in Stockholm, and André had a desk job in Stockholm for all these years, and they'd been in the Arctic for 6 weeks or so preparing to leave, and they thought they were very fit, but they because they weren't by nature outdoorsmen, I think they overestimated their, and certainly did not want to leave the balloon. It took a week to sort of pack the sledges and decide what to bring. And they obviously, you wouldn't want to walk off leaving a lot of food behind and that sort of thing. So they sort of took everything without also, mind you, they'd seen the ice from the air, which flattens all the perspective. And when you get down among it, you see it's an absolute wreck of, crashed up pieces of ice and broken things and places where the ice is soft and your feet fall through and all sorts of disasters. They sometimes spent days where they would only make a few hundred yards. Yeah. And the other thing they would do, I know you that your question reminded me of, is sometimes the sledges were so heavy they'd have, and one or two of them might be injured, they'd have to sort of all three pull one sledge ahead a certain distance, then go back and get the others and push it. So they were a very slow-moving caravan.
Yeah, and it's even more challenging because the landscape, such as it is, would always be shifting.
Yes. Well, that was the terrible, terrible irony, which is that they didn't understand, as they, fought desperately. Arctic work was called the white warfare. As they fought desperately to achieve this ground, they didn't realize at first that the ice was moving in the opposite direction beneath them. As André wrote, finally, when he discovered this, he said, out on the ice, it's impossible to see that it's moving. But they would, go miles in one direction and discover that during the same period, the ice had moved almost as many miles in the opposite direction. So it was a horrible, there must have been a terrible moment when it was borne in on them that what they were actually trying to do was not achievable, and yeah, they would probably die.
So when their bodies were found in 1930, they were brought back to Sweden. What did they get a hero's welcome?
Oh, my. They got, all the way through Norway and Sweden and, a kind of funeral train, only funeral ship in this case, putting into various ports and a gathering. When they hit Stockholm, they had 200 boats behind their boat, and there were planes in the air and gunshots being fired. They were great, great heroes, and it was a great, of the period. They were, it wasn't, they were legends. It wasn't, we've somehow in the modern era lost sight of them, but if you ever, anytime I meet anybody from Sweden, I say, did you ever hear of S.A. André? And sometimes they can't place the name, but once you describe the association, they go, oh, yes, we studied him in school. Mm. It was an astonishing thing to find these men who had been lost, it was thought, forever, and their fate unknown, and to find them, and not only to find them and recover them, but to now be able to see from these journals that had to be dried out very carefully, so that they didn't the pages didn't tear and that sort of thing. This delicate operation, and then the photographs, to find these rolls of film and to be able, by the most modern means available to them, to very delicately and carefully develop them, and to see these men come back to life. Was really like in these watery images that couldn't be, the blacks and whites of which couldn't be brought back in full force. So they looked sort of watery, and absolute, anyone who looks at them almost feels that he or she is looking at a photograph of a ghost. Yeah. It's a very strange bulletin from the afterlife.
It's a great story. If people want to read it, the title of the book is The Ice Balloon by our guest Alec Wilkinson. He writes for The New Yorker. Knopf, the publisher. Hey, thanks very much for talking with us
today.
Thank
you, David. A pleasure. I hope I didn't go on too great length.
Oh, you're wonderful. You're wonderful. Thanks.
Thank you.